Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Monday, November 1st. Parents and grandparents of the world, take note this morning. Your kids and grandkids may be angrier about the climate you're leaving them than you are and than you realize. You're probably hearing that the COP26 climate summit with President Biden and other world leaders is taking place today in Glasgow, Scotland, right? COP, by the way, in case you're hearing this term and you don't know what it means, COP stands for Conference of the Parties of the Paris Climate Accords of 2015. It's their 26th meeting, so COP26. What you may not be hearing about is protests by mostly young people that are taking place alongside COP26. For example, yesterday at the official opening speech by COP26 President Alok Sharma, who's a member of the British Parliament, he got interrupted by a group of young protesters accusing him of spouting words without actions to back them up. Listen carefully. So there was that at the opening of COP26 yesterday as one example. And there was 18-year-old Greta Thunberg on the BBC. She's, of course, most well known for giving voice to generational anger at what her peers are being handed to solve themselves. Greta was asked if some of the young activists' disruption tactics are worth it, given the criticism that those tactics draw.
I think as long as, of course, to make clear, as long as no one gets hurt and as long as, then I think sometimes you need to anger some people. Like, for instance, the school strike movement would never have become so big if there wasn't friction, if some people didn't get pissed off.
The school strike movement, referring to the Fridays for Future school climate strikes of 2018 and 2019. Greta Thunberg on the BBC going into COP26. And consider this number from a Pew Research poll released this spring. Two-thirds of Gen Z Americans, that is 67% of Americans 23 years old or younger, say they've talked about the need for climate action in the past few weeks. It was almost as high for millennials, 61%, but down to 53% of Gen X Americans and 50% of baby boomers. So fairly different across the generations how much people are talking on an ongoing basis. The question was in the last few weeks about the need for climate action. And there are other numbers in that Pew poll that indicate the younger Americans inheriting the climate crisis are more engaged with the issue than the older Americans who are leaving them with it. And we'll use that as a starting point for the COP26 conversations that we'll be having this week and welcome our first guest. Marcella Mulholland, political director of the progressive think tank Data for Progress. Her Twitter feed this weekend included a lot about the climate. There was also something about a Halloween costume that we'll get into. Marcella, thanks for coming on when you might rather be watching this summit unfold. Welcome to WNYC.
Thanks so much for having me on, Brian. I'm excited to talk with you.
Marcella, first things first, was the Halloween costume photo you going as Kyrsten Sinema?
Yes, it was. I thought the purple wig and the broken foot boot gave it away. But yes, I dressed up as one of the scarier characters of this season of American politics for Halloween.
Very hilarious. And you tweeted, "Parents are really taking my costume to heart." What kinds of reactions did you get?
Well, my parents are Florida swing voter baby boomers, so they're amused by my political antics and are now referring to me as senator because of the costume.
That is doubly hilarious. I will say it's been Senator Joe Manchin from the coal state of West Virginia who's been open about his objections to the clean power part of the Build Back Better bill. Sinema has been largely silent, I think, except for denying a New York Times report that she was looking to cut the climate spending portion. So how do you see her role in that compared to Manchin's?
Yeah, I think obviously both of them have been really difficult characters in the whole infrastructure negotiations of the last several months. Manchin obviously is from West Virginia, to what you mentioned. It's a really coal-heavy state, so I think he is really protective of continuing the trajectory of the coal industry's existence in that state, which doesn't look very good in general, but... Sinema, on the other hand, is from Arizona, which is, you know, a state that is already experiencing really drastic extreme heat events. And I think perhaps she's feeling more pressure from her constituents and just kind of reading the room that Arizona is a state that's really going to be dealing with climate impact. So has chosen perhaps other areas of the bills and the infrastructure fight to kind of stake her claim on, for instance, prescription drug negotiations, some of the other areas that she's been more obstructionist on compared to climate, whereas I think Joe Manchin kind of really sees it as kind of his job to be seen as like killing a lot of these climate provisions, unfortunately.
Still thinking about that costume and you going with the boot, which shows Kyrsten Sinema's injured foot, right? I wonder if anybody in New York was quick enough on the uptake after the Republican mayoral candidate Curtis Sliwa got injured in an accident with a taxi cab on Saturday, I guess, and broke his arm Curtis Sliwa in a sling. That would have been a good couples costume. I'm thinking
that would have been
here.
A good couple costume,
right? Curtis Sliwa in a sling and Kyrsten Sinema in a boot going door to door in New York City.
very niche, but I think for the people who understand it, it's funny. I think with the boot, it's just like all of this feels a bit absurd at times. And I remember, I mean, Sinema wears all these like kind of eccentric outfits and then was like having the broken foot while she was like making all these press conferences. It all felt a bit dystopic, but niche political costumes are my thing.
Marcella Mulholland, political director of Data for Progress, our guest. We'll get to your phone calls in just a minute. Our lines are already totally full. How much of a generational divide to help set up these calls on climate action, or maybe I should say on climate urgency, do you see, or do you see as important?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the concerns that younger people have is that many of the lawmakers determining climate policy in the United States and globally are much less impacted by the effects of the incoming climate crisis because they're much older than us. And the truth is that my generation, younger generations, will be the ones to take on the climate crisis, and the weight of that responsibility is really reflected on the public opinion that we see with young voters across the country really consistently ranking climate change as one of their top priorities for Congress to act on. And we're seeing it with the activism that's taking place in Glasgow right now at COP26 that you mentioned earlier with Greta and some of the other climate activists interrupting speeches and really calling for more action to happen quickly.
The New York Times has a pretty comprehensive COP26 preview article by Somini Sengupta that includes an analysis of the divisions that make COP26 likely to disappoint. And they include the United States and Europe against emerging industrial economies like China, India, and South Africa that still want room to develop their industrial economies and not have to slow down as much as us on fossil fuels. And then even those countries as emerging polluters against small, vulnerable countries like the low-lying island nations of the Caribbean and South Pacific, which might find themselves literally underwater. How can things like those be resolved?
Yeah, I think you raise a good point about this being really a global problem that requires international cooperation. And Data for Progress released some polling ahead of COP26 that showed that a majority of Democrats, independents, and Republicans all want the United States to work with other countries to address climate change. I think specifically, often people will raise concerns like if these other big emitters aren't doing enough on climate, like why should the United States? And what our polling shows is that kind of messaging really doesn't persuade many voters. We find that a majority of voters want the U.S. to lead on climate, even if other countries are slower to take action. So I think what's really clear here is that there's broad support amongst the American electorate for the United States to take a leadership role, both domestically and globally, to tackle this issue.
And Catherine in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hi, Catherine.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. Yeah, so both my husband and I are millennials, and we work in climate change adaptation. I'm in adaptation for housing. He's in renewable energy. And something that really struck me about my parents, who are upper middle class white baby boomers, talking about climate change, was that it really shifted for them when they started to look at houses down the shore to retire to. And, you know, watching my dad suddenly look at things like flood factor and check to see if the property they were going to invest in was climate resilient. And so I think that speaks to a larger issue where focusing on future generations doesn't do the trick anymore. I think it's a little bit antiquated as well since climate change is here. I think baby boomers and Gen Xers would talk more about the issue if we framed it as something that's happening now and happening to them and has impacts on their lives currently, not just their grandkids. Thank you.
Thank you. Marcella, you think that's changing already in that direction, maybe because of the severe weather events that have taken place around the world this year?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's no question that we need to stop talking about climate change as something that's a far-off threat and rather address it as a problem that's already here and is already impacting people's lives and livelihoods today. I mentioned earlier, I grew up in South Florida and my parents live really close to the beach. And I think, you know, whether or not your political views or political affiliation are aligned with, you know, progressive climate activists or not, like there are people who already live near the water, already live in hurricane prone areas and places with heat waves that are seeing and considering climate change in their decisions about the future, be it home ownership or otherwise. So I think that's a really fair point. And we saw in our polling increased support for climate action or increased concern for extreme weather events after the hurricane season we saw and the wildfires out west in California. And I anticipate that will only become more and more true, unfortunately, every year as these extreme weather events become more dire and impact even more people than they already are.
But she makes an interesting point about messaging, like maybe there's a way to say, yeah, this is going to affect your kids and your grandkids and be concerned for that reason. But this is going to affect your retirement, like today, tomorrow, 10 years from now.
Totally. Yeah, I think that's a really valid point, especially for older people and people who are concerned about their savings and their property and other things like that. You certainly should adapt your messaging, I think, to what the values and priorities are for the audience that you're speaking to.
Joe in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi, Joe.
Hi. Thanks, Brian. I love this show. I'm calling to say, you know, back in 2019 when Greta Thunberg came through, I was marching with all of them and it was very inspiring. But, you know, I realized my parents and grandparents, it sounds very cynical to say, are going to leave the world before it gets really awful, you know? I want to echo what other callers said is, you know, a lot of people my age are looking up land. I personally grew up in New Jersey. I looked up, you know, what 2 feet of sea rise will do, you know, because we were hit pretty hard with Sandy. And I think that's, you know, most people, my parents' generation, are more concerned with what will happen to their property as opposed to what will happen 80 years later, you know.
Joe, thank you very much. Are you watching COP26, Joe, with any kind of eye to the specifics coming out of it? Or does it look like a lot of fuzz from a lot of older world leaders?
It unfortunately looks like a lot of fuzz. I really have been disillusioned with electoral politics lately. I wonder, for example, even if the Green New Deal had its best case scenario, maybe 20 years down the line, what would that even look like, especially in regards to the previous caller regarding resources in other countries? It's tough to say, you know.
Joe, thank you very much. Well, To that point, and to some of what we've been talking about, thinking about the previous caller, Marcella, the earlier caller, who said 2050 for net zero emissions from the United States is too long to wait. President Biden cites that number, that date. Of course, he's in Glasgow right now. I want to play three clips of Biden from his Earth Day speech, April 22nd of this year, and get your take, your assessment of U.S. climate policy under Biden and how much you think he's delivering going into Glasgow, because he says he's trying to bring other world leaders along. I'm curious how much you think he's bringing himself along. He listed on Earth Day a whole number of things that climate policy means to him, that instead of thinking about climate protection policy as costing the economy, for example, think of it as creating a whole raft of categories of new jobs. And here's one of them that he cited.
I see workers capping hundreds of thousands of abandoned oil and gas wells that need to be cleaned up, and abandoned coal mines that need to be reclaimed, putting a stop to the methane leaks and protecting the health of our communities.
So that's one. And we've talked already in this segment about agriculture, the way it's done in the world these days, generally, as such a big contributor to the climate crisis. The president brought that up on Earth Day, too.
I see farmers deploying cutting-edge tools to make soil of our heartland the next frontier in carbon innovation.
And he had a whole long list of other American jobs that he thinks could be created through Build Back Better and other climate policies. And then he put it in the global perspective.
You know, these steps will set America on a path of net zero emissions economy by no later than 2050. But the truth is, America represents less than 15% of the world's emissions. No nation can solve this crisis on our own, as I know you all fully understand. All of us, and particularly those of us who represent the world's largest economies, we have to step up.
President Biden on Earth Day, April 22nd this year. So, Marcella, compare and contrast what you've been hearing from President Biden on Earth Day or through the year, or what's actually in Build Back Better, which is still being debated in Congress. See your Halloween costume of Kyrsten Sinema. And what he's proposing at Glasgow at COP26 compared to what you advocate at Data for Progress or other youth-driven climate crisis movements like the Sunrise Movement.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to take a moment and just recognize really how far the climate movement has been able to push the Democratic Party on climate. Just a few years ago and in the last Democratic administration, it really would have been unfathomable to have Democratic leadership in Congress and in the White House talking about climate change in the way that we're hearing them talk about it now, like we just heard Joe Biden talk about it in the speech clips you played. So I think we should feel really excited and inspired by that. Obviously, you know, getting folks to pay lip service to an issue is different than actually getting legislation passed, especially in the US Senate, where we have things like the filibuster and these really anti-democratic policies and practices that make it extremely difficult to get things passed. But I think, you know, as lawmakers finalize the details of the Build Better Act, it's really clear that voters and the American public strongly support investments to tackle climate change and transition to clean energy. They really support policies that center farmers, like President Biden mentioned in the speech you just played, workers, clean energy workers, things like a civilian climate corps to put millions of Americans to work on this issue. And while, you know, the plan isn't as ambitious as folks like myself would hope, it's not as ambitious as President Biden's initial plans and proposals on the campaign trail and at the beginning of his term. But there's no question that if we are able to pass the reconciliation package and the Build Back Better Act will make huge strides toward addressing the climate crisis. There's more than $555 billion in climate spending, which is, you know, exponentially larger than any prior climate investments that the U.S. government has made in the past. Unfortunately, this is a problem that's big enough to where, you know, that still isn't enough. But there's no question that we really need to get these two infrastructure bills passed, and we need to do it quickly and then continue working on all of the other levers that the government has to help to advance decarbonization, be it through the agencies and the regulatory system or otherwise.
And we're going to leave it there with Marcella Mulholland, Political Director for Data for Progress, except to ask you, what do you see as success? What should we look for as potential success? Or maybe the best potential case scenario after all this preview coverage leading up to COP26, honestly, has been about how disappointing it's likely to be. Putin isn't there. Xi Jinping isn't there. John Kerry, you know, on behalf of President Biden, has been going around the world. He hasn't been able to get the commitments that he's wanted from Saudi Arabia, big oil producing country, and other places. So what's the most that we can expect out of COP26 this week? And will it be something that you could even potentially hail as success?
I mean, I think success to me looks like ending this week with the United States having passed two infrastructure packages that make really big down payments and investments in our climate and our country and world's future. Obviously, with COP26 happening, all eyes are on kind of the international stage. But in order for any of the words that U.S. diplomats, be it Kerry or even President Biden, say abroad, they really need to follow it up with action here domestically. And what that means is passing the Build Back Better Act, getting the climate investments that we've all fought so hard for actually across the finish line, signed into law, so that we can really get to work here on decarbonizing the United States and, as a consequence of that, helping the whole world tackle climate change.
Marcella, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.